Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump this week unveiled his plan to address the opioid crisis, including expanded access to addiction treatment and substance abuse education. He also called for capital punishment for certain drug dealers. In remarks before a New Hampshire audience, his rhetoric recalled the war on drug era of the Reagan administration.
But if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
He said that to applause. Joining us now to put the president's proposal into context is Associated Press legal affairs writer and author of the 2009 book, No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States, Andrew Welsh Huggins. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And also Ohio State University Moritz College of Law professor Douglas Berman. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann.
And by phone, behavioral health policy consultant Andrew Kessler. Welcome back. I should say welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Andrew Kessler, in general, what did we learn from the war on drugs, from that era?
Well, we learned that it was not the best tactic for a variety of reasons. It proved highly ineffective. And what it did from the perspective of people who work on this issue from a policy perspective is it really stigmatized drug use and the disease of addiction. Addiction is a disease, and we've come really far since the days of the war on drugs, and we've convinced policymakers that drug use, drug abuse, drug addiction, it's really more of a public health problem and should be framed as such than a criminal justice problem. And all the war on drugs did was stigmatize drug use. It made people afraid to seek out the help they needed. And when you use terminology like war, that is a very strong word. So not only were people who dealt drugs viewed as an enemy or a combatant, but people who unfortunately were addicted and used drugs, they were kind of seen as enemies too. And the people who wanted to provide treatment or the people who wanted to provide recovery services, when you use rhetoric like war, those people can be viewed as possibly giving aid to the enemy. You know, it's a really powerful word. It was really powerful rhetoric, and it really set us back because all of the focus was on arresting and it was on punishment, and none of the focus was on treatment and recovery. And since the war on drugs, we've shifted to that focus on treatment and recovery. We've made some really good strides, so it's not a place we want to go back to.
You know, that get tough on drugs thing is often associated, Andrew Welsh Huggins, with the Reagan administration, the war on drugs, and that sort of thing. But my experience has been that it was really in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, when the old three strikes and you're out and all the tougher sanctions and that kind of a thing at the state level became a thing.
That's right. The essentially complicated topic, but the crack cocaine epidemic helped spur a lot of these get tough on crime. We're locking you up and throwing away the key. And states like Ohio are wrestling with the effect of that now. We have, you know, our prison population is just under 50,000, and a lot of those people are there because of drug offenses. So, yeah, it was the 90s where, driven by the crack cocaine epidemic, authorities started saying, okay, we're gonna toughen things up, and that's when you got Senate Bill 2 in Ohio and just a lot harsher sentencing. But the result now is we're spending billions of dollars that we don't really have to house thousands and thousands of inmates that a generation ago we didn't have those numbers. And the state's trying to deal with that with some mixed success right now.
You know, Doug Berman, can we equivocate when it comes to laws? Does the effectiveness of a law matter in the long run to the rule of law?
In lots of ways. And I actually want to push back a little bit on even discussing the war on drugs in past tense terms. Certainly, we were fighting it with even more rigor and vigor in the 80s and the 90s. But not just, you know, the president getting applause for saying we should be thinking about the death penalty for major traffickers. But the reality that at the lowest level, we still have over 1.5 million arrests every single year for drug offenses. We still have half of the federal prison population in there for drug offenses. The largest category of federal offenses still is drug offenses. And so we've done a better job of understanding that public health responses have proved more effective and are important in treating our nation's drug problems. But we still have this very strong and I think sort of viscerally problematic instinct that the criminal justice system has to be at the front lines of dealing with these problems. And I think it's proven ineffective across a number of settings. And I think we see often from the ground up, marijuana reform is one example where we see the people through ballot initiatives and others saying we want different approaches. We don't believe this is the right approach. And I think it hurts the legitimacy of the law. There's lots of data on DARE programs going into schools and suggesting the risks are high, and then kids seeing whether in their community or through their peers that doesn't match up with what they're experiencing, and they have less respect for following a law because they don't understand the kind of rhetoric that matches up with the reality that they're seeing. And so those are all concerns, not just for this particular problem, drug abuse, drug use and abuse in our country, but for the broader relationship between the individual and their governments.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're taking a look, a moment to put into context the president's three-pronged approach to addressing the opioid crisis, including expanded access to addiction treatment, substance abuse education, and also capital punishment for certain kinds of drug dealers. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Andrew Kessler, is it an either-or proposition, or does it feel that way when you're in the treatment end of things, that when the president's calling for things like capital punishment and getting tougher on dealers, it kind of eclipses everything that went before, what he said about better access and that kind of thing?
Well, it definitely dominates the narrative. And that's really probably the biggest cause for concern. On paper, the plan that the White House put forward, which is based in part on the report of the president's commission on opioids that submitted their 56 recommendations to the White House several months ago. Mm-hmm. On paper, it's a very good plan, and it addresses treatment, it addresses prevention, it addresses infrastructure and a variety of other areas. But criminal justice is also part of the equation. So I wouldn't say it necessarily, it's not necessarily an either or, but when we get to the narrative and when we get to the president speaking in New Hampshire and right off the bat, saying that he wants to take a law and order approach, talking about illegal immigration, talking about the death penalty, and kind of just glossing over any mentions of treatment, it's a cause for concern because, in any plan, there's going to be priorities, and it's a tough environment to get any policy passed in Washington, obviously, even though this is a very bipartisan issue and we have support from both sides of the aisle, it's a tough environment. So when the president leads with those issues, it becomes kind of eclipses. You use the word eclipse, and I guess that's a good word for it. It eclipses everything else. When the sun blocks out the, when there's a lunar eclipse, that doesn't mean the moon's not there anymore, but you can't see it. The treatment aspects of the plan are still there, but nobody's talking about it. And policy is driven in very large part by what society is talking about. Congress does react to whatever buzz is being generated. In part, that's why they're addressing the opioid epidemic, because society did make so much buzz about it. So it's not an either-or proposition, but there is some concern that the takeaway is more about the law and order approach.
The law and order approach, Andrew Welsh Huggins, is expensive.
It is expensive. Up to the if you look at some of the data on the war on drugs, to the tune of $40 billion or more over the years. And this gets back to are we ready to let's take the proposal to I think Doug has put this well. It's not actually to create a death penalty law, I believe, for drug offenders, but to use more of this federal law that allows for the punishment of, I guess, drug kingpins associated with deaths. But in any case, are we ready to – if that's the top point, are we then talking about a new tough-on-drugs approach that will filter down and refill the prisons at a time when we're trying to reduce the populations to reduce crime, but also to save money? It costs a lot of money. I mean, the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction in Ohio is the most expensive agency, and they're trying to reduce those costs. And there's just not a lot of money floating around state government right now. Are people ready to fund that?
Right. You have to fund the prisons. You have to make sure the doors lock and the guards are on duty and the inmates are fed. But when it comes to the treatment issue of the drug crisis, that's negotiable. That is, you can decide, well, this year we're going to give X million dollars fewer to that, but we have to fund the prisons. It's like Medicaid or something like that.
Well, that's true.
It's fixed.
And to the prison's credit, and to, you know, Governor Kasich has made, and the legislative leaders have made this a top priority, and they've enacted reforms to try to put fewer people in prison, mainly people with a drug abuse problem at the focus of their problems, put fewer of them in prison, or at least keep them there for shorter periods of time, get them back into the community where they can get treatment. I think everyone recognizes that prison is not a place to go if you want to recover from your addiction, that you need to be with the experts who can give you that intensive work you need. But if we're going back to a tough on drugs approach, are we really going to see that? And I would also say this kind of gets into this, you know, this division we're facing as a nation. There's some irony in the president announcing that approach. At the same time, so many states, including Ohio, are moving towards legalizing marijuana. And you have to wonder, which is in direct contrast to the whole war on drugs approach. People are coming to believe that marijuana should not be included in that, and it represents a kind of sea change in society. So how does that movement line up against sort of the opposite thing? Well, we're going to start executing drug dealers, and that opens up a whole another question of who are we talking about here? What drug dealers?
Well, we already know. I mean, Attorney General Sessions has given the go-ahead to the attorney, to his people, that even if it's legal in some states, that they should be going after the dealers.
Yeah, so the Doug Berman marijuana policy could readily occupy a couple more shows, but it's absolutely right that Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General, has taken a different approach than the Obama administration Attorneys General, which was a more hands-off, if folks are complying with state laws, the federal government ought not make enforcement of federal prohibition of marijuana a priority. Sessions hasn't said it should be a priority. He's just said, I want to go back to sort of the standard issue, letting every U.S. attorney balance, from their perspective, the right way to deal with this issue. But that's an ever-growing tension, and I think Andrew's exactly right that there's a dichotomy in, if we want to get tougher and think law enforcement's the way to go, which drugs are we talking about? In the context of the speech in New Hampshire, it seems clear he's focused on opioids, and
right,
in particular, and you know, this is a serious problem. Fentanyl has sort of emerged as a new drug on the scene that's uniquely lethal, and I suspect, were we to see the attorney general go after some drug dealers with the death penalty or the toughest possible punishments, it will be a focus on who they can identify as involved in fentanyl. One of the problems, however, is a lot of dealers don't even know what they have in their opiate package, whether it's heroin, whether it's fentanyl. There's reports that fentanyl is getting mixed in with other illicit narcotics
farther up the food chain.
Yeah, and these are challenges even for chemists, let alone for street level or mid level or even kingpin dealers. And so and that's a challenge that itself comes into any criminal justice approach, right? That if we identify, well, these are the worst kinds of dealers, how do we make sure those are the only ones we're targeting? The use of broad mandatory minimums throughout you know, sort of the toughest period of the war on drugs, regularly caught up lower level users and street level dealers that the rhetoric was we're only going after the kingpins. But the reality was those folks get caught up partially because law enforcement wants to try to leverage their information to move up the chain, mm-hmm. get higher level dealers. But that's challenging for a range of law enforcement reasons. And it gets back to what we're talking about before in terms of the expense. Every dollar being invested in that kind of supply side criminal justice enforcement is almost always inevitably going to be one less dollar for demand reduction, working on treatment. The data suggests that less than 10% of roughly 2 million addicts in the United States have even access to treatment to deal with those sets of problems. And if that's not a focal point, if that's not addressed, there's always going to be enough demand that's going to lead new people to try to provide the supply and make a quick buck doing so. And so these are the sets of problems that make drug policy reform so challenging. And, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it's not just a story of what's the plan on paper. It's what become the priorities of the people trying to implement that, not only at the federal level, but at the state level, at the local level.
We are looking at the president's plan to address the opioid crisis. It includes embracing the death penalty and ending the opioid crisis. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You just heard from Douglas Berman. He's a professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Also with us by phone, Andrew Kessler, behavioral health policy consultant, and Andrew Welsh Huggins. He's an Associated Press legal affairs writer and author of the 2009 book, No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about President Trump's plan to embrace the death penalty as part of ending his plan to end the opioid crisis. He also supports expanding treatment, giving more access to treatment. Still with us by phone, behavioral health policy consultant Andrew Kessler. And in the studio, OSU law professor Douglas Berman and Associated Press legal affairs writer Andrew Welsh Huggins. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Andrew Kessler, the president talked about ending the, quote, scourge of drug addiction in America once and for all. What is your sense about whether something like that is possible?
Yeah, that's a million or in this case, potentially billion or even trillion-dollar question. Addiction is a disease, and it's been defined as such by the American Medical Association since the late 50s. And to say you're going to end addiction once and for all means you have to be vested in curing that disease. And it's a chronic disease. And there are many chronic diseases that we, as Americans, can live with, and we have maintenance therapy for, such as diabetes or lupus, or even with HIV, people are living longer and longer because maintenance therapies have become so advanced. Mm-hmm. But none of those diseases have been cured. So until we cure addiction, it's a pretty beyond bold statement to say we're going to end this once and for all. To truly end addiction and define that cure, we would have to continue to invest billions in research and neuroscience, determine what practices work best, use that evidence, and, of course, focus a lot more on prevention. And when I say focus more on prevention, I'm not talking about just say no, which failed so miserably. I know the president said that the center point of his plan will be commercials that will scare kids. Yeah. And he used those words. That did not work. So I'm all for investing in prevention and investing heavily. Our research shows that $1 invested in prevention can save anywhere from $7 down the road to as much as $17 down the road if that is an evidence-based prevention plan used in a school setting. So when I say invest in prevention, I'm talking from a community standpoint, working with community coalitions, working with effective messages that work. That would be the number one way to go about ending this, quote unquote, once and for all, to invest even heavier in prevention. But like Doug said before, there's always going to be demand. And why is there always going to be demand? Because the disease of addiction is a neurological disease. It originates in the brain. And until we figure out why two people or even two relatives from the same family with almost the same genetic makeup, why one could have a glass of beer and say, that was fun, and not drink again for another week or even month, and the other person can have that first drink and say, where have you been all my life? This is all I'm going to do. And they become, they fall into addiction's grip. And many people have said addiction is a disease where the brain has been hijacked. So until we figure out the brain and figure out effective maintenance and even cures that work on that, this disease is going to be with us. So once and for all, is not really a realistic expectation.
Clinton in Cincinnati, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about the death penalty piece of this. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
I somewhat agree. I don't agree with Trump all like that. And my thing is, if we set an example and show these people that we won't allow them in our country, and potentially kill them, so to say, which is kind of bad to say, but, you know, it will help us show them that we're tired of them bringing drugs in the country. The other guy who was just on was talking about addiction. Yes, we will have addiction. We will always have addiction. At the end of the day, we just need to focus on the drugs coming into our country. Once we cut that off, then we can worry about the addiction piece. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, Clinton. Thank you. Andrew Kessler, Clinton's talking about first stop the flow of drugs, then deal with the people left behind who are already addicted.
Yeah, the concept of drugs being imported by mules or immigrants has kind of been, based on my research, blown out of proportion, especially as it pertains to the biggest problem we're dealing with right now, which is fentanyl. I know one of your guests mentioned fentanyl earlier. Mm-hmm. That's coming in the U.S. now, mm-hmm. from China, from Mexico. The bulk of fentanyl, which is causing so many overdose problems, is coming through the U.S. mail. While it's true that some drugs are being brought in through human means, through smuggling. Mm-hmm. The opioid epidemic that we're facing right now, it started in the medicine cabinet. And it's been well documented how many people have become addicted to opioids through a road of either they were prescribed it or they took it from a relative. So we're really not, you know, to focus only on the illicit smuggling aspect is to ignore other sources of the drugs. Yes, there are drugs that come in illegally via human means. But as long as drug manufacturers continue to produce and promote and doctors continue to prescribe drugs like OxyContin, and as long as even alcohol and tobacco are available, people are going to be susceptible to addiction. A lot of people say that marijuana may be a gateway drug. They should take a look at tobacco first, because you talk to any addict, and odds are good their first addiction of choice was either smoking or drinking. So we're not just talking about heroin. We're not just talking about cocaine and marijuana, and we're not just talking about drug smuggling in the way we see it in the movies. That is a small piece of it, and it's a piece that needs to be addressed. I will never say that we shouldn't try our hardest to block the smuggling of drugs, but we're in a much more advanced era where, and we need to expand how we think about substances and substances that are abused. They can be legal, they could be illegal, they could come in the mail, they could come in via smuggling, they could be found in the medicine chest. So it's a much bigger universe. Let's not focus on one tiny aspect of it. Let's focus on the whole universe.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You know, when I was listening to Andrew Kessler talk just now, Andrew Welsh Huggins, it kind of reminded me, what if we do focus on the proverbial mules and that kind of aspect of this issue over, you know, the medicine cabinet approach, it reminded me a little bit of the whole differentiation we made back in the 80s, especially between crack and cocaine, that it affects how when you approach it in that kind of a way, it affects who's affect, you know, different people are affected by it.
Yeah, a couple of things there. So in that scenario, you know, it's been well documented that, you know, penalties for crack cocaine were much harsher than for sort of powdered cocaine, and those penalties fell much heavier on minority communities. The other thing, following up on what Andrew said, which is, a really good point. Right now, in a federal courtroom in Cleveland, a judge is overseeing at this point more than 400 lawsuits that have been brought against drug makers and drug distributors, including Ohio's own Cardinal Health. And those companies have been accused in hundreds, probably thousands of lawsuits at this point of being responsible for, you know, getting us in this mess to begin with through the inappropriate marketing of opioids and then through allegedly questionable distribution. You know, there's now this famous story of the West Virginia town that was getting, God knows how many thousands of pills per inhabitant. So what are we supposed to do with how do those companies fall into this sort of get tough on crime? Because, you know, this judge is trying to negotiate some kind of settlement with these companies who have been accused, like I said, of putting us right where we are now.
Knowingly. That's the issue, right, Doug Berman?
Yeah. And,
knowing.
And I actually want to speak to what the caller was suggesting. I think it's part of why not only President Trump is sort of drawn to talking about the death penalty for drug dealers, but why we heard a round of applause when he brought this up during his speech earlier this week. It has a kind of symbolic salience, a kind of resonance for those who are inclined to say this is our biggest problem and we need to bring our biggest solutions. The problem is it's practically never going to do anything other than be symbolically important. But I think it's important, as the caller suggests, that if you look at this problem as not only our most dire, but one that we ought to try everything on, even if it might not work. And there's no evidence that the death penalty in this context will really be effective in dramatically shifting anything in this universe. But you like that symbolism. That symbolism is important to you as a statement. Oftentimes, and this gets back to the crack powder story, right? The symbolism on the ground ended up having extraordinary racial disproportions in who got the harshest sentences and the application of those penalties. The same is true historically with the death penalty as well. And so it's not just recognizing the populism behind this call for the death penalty in this setting. It's then understanding that it's going to have a range of echo effects, as Andrew suggested before. It blocks out all the other things that needs to get done. We're talking about the resources it may reallocate or misallocate, and it reinforces the sense, this is the biggest concern I have, that there's likely to be effectiveness from these kinds of symbolic criminal justice approaches. And the data suggests, the effectiveness is questionable at best, and in all likelihood is far less effective than a range of other evidence-based approaches to dealing with addiction and even doing supply-side intervention that approaches these issues much more strategically and effectively than just the death penalty for some unnamed drug dealer that we can't even really identify who we're talking about.
Kathy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
I am a recovering heroin addict, 6 months now, and the reason I started was my doctor. I was in pain management, and he failed to follow his own contract. He kept upping my medication and upping my medication. He never once checked the medication to make sure I was following it as prescribed. Yes, I know it was a choice for me to continue to use, but by that time, I was already spiraling. And 3 years after I'd been seeing him, he finally decides to start checking my medication to make sure I have what I'm supposed to have at the end of the month. And by that time, it was too late. And his idea was cut her completely off and throw her to the streets. And that's how it started. And these doctors, I mean, they're part of the problem, too. I hate to say that because, I mean, they can help some people, but the ones that are just out there saying, hey, here you go, take this, take this, take this, it'll help. And education is the way to go.
You know,
because you can't just penalize the neighborhood drug dealer, because a lot of the doctors are at fault, too.
Kathy, if you had, when you were prescribed the drugs, what would you have wanted to know about them?
How addicting they truly were. When I first started into pain management, I had no insurance. So I was having to pay for medications myself, out of pocket.
Wow.
And when he put me on a 24-hour extended release pill, I couldn't afford it. It was like $200 a month for like 30 pills. So he put me on a medication that he said was cheaper than peanuts. His words. He put me on methadone. I had no idea what methadone was at the time. And he was right. It cost me less than $20 a month for 120 tablets.
Wow. Well, good luck.
That's synthetic heroin.
Yeah.
That's what they give heroin addicts.
Right.
To get off of the to get off of it. So by that time, it was too late.
If someone had said, here are these pills, they'll address your pain, but be aware that they are highly addictive, that might have changed your behavior.
Definitely.
Thank you, Kathy, and best wishes.
Thank you.
Take care. We will continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about President Trump's proposal to fight the opioid crisis. His plan includes the death penalty as a possible punishment for drug dealers. It's supposed to deter them. He's also talking about education and more access to treatment. Still with us is Associated Press legal affairs writer Andrew Welsh Huggins, OSU law professor Douglas Berman, and behavioral health policy consultant Andrew Kessler. We just heard from a caller, Kathy Andrew Kessler, that kind of described what I would call at this point in the game of covering the issue, a classic situation of how the addiction starts and takes hold.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad Kathy is healthy and yeah, doing well. And it's interesting that she told that story. The warning that it could be highly addictive is what was lacking for many years. And unfortunately, Purdue Pharma played a role in that by downplaying the warnings that they knew about. Doctors were not advised, and in turn, patients were not advised. And I think her story complements exactly what I was talking about before. Why can one person take those pills and have absolutely no reaction, yet another person takes the pill, and all of a sudden they're off and running because it's triggered something, and they are in addiction's grip. Her mention of methadone was really interesting. I was in a congressional hearing a couple of years ago, and a health expert was being asked, why are we prescribing methadone for pain? And the insurance expert who was testifying said, do you want the truth? The member of Congress said yes, and he said, because it's cheapest. Methadone was never intended, as your caller said, methadone was never intended to treat pain. The fact that it does, you know, doesn't mean that, you know, it should. Yes, it was cheap, but it is a highly addictive substance for those who are susceptible to the disease of addiction. And unfortunately, Kathy's story is all too common, and it kind of encapsulates the problem we're dealing with. Once you, regardless of what door you was your entree into addiction, you're going to seek out whatever is going to feed that, and whatever's cheapest. And in her case, and in many cases, it was heroin, and now it's heroin with fentanyl. So we have seen research that tracks this kind of use, and we have seen research that from the CDC that. That backs it up and that proves, unfortunately, it is a very common story.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, what do we know about public support for these get tough on drug dealer laws?
Well, I think,
in particular, the death penalty as well.
So, with all these get tough things, there's sort of the first answer and then the second answer. So if we just take the death penalty, it's pretty well established that even now, if you ask people, do you favor the death penalty for the most serious murders, the majority, although it's a decreasing majority, but still the majority of Americans are going to say yes. If you ask the follow-up question, would you support life with no possibility of parole as a alternative, a larger majority will agree with that statement. So, again, as Doug said a moment ago, it's all about the symbolism here. People like that idea of getting tough because, especially if you look at this opioid epidemic, this is a really tough situation we're going through here. And there's been numerous stories about kind of compassion fatigue involving the addicts, because this is such a pernicious disease. We're talking about people who are repeatedly revived with naloxone, stories of them, you know, being revived, stumbling away from the scene, going right back and using. And yes, that's hard for people to stomach if you don't understand the way opioids rewire people's brains. And so I would say the initial reaction to getting tough on that has some traction, because people are frustrated sometimes with their own relatives and they think a tougher approach is needed. But as we've seen again with the war on drugs and with our current prison population, just punishing those addicts who maybe sometimes they're also dealers, I don't think is going to get to the root of the problem.
And a lot of people are in prison for crimes not directly related to drug dealing or drug abuse, but crimes committed to get the money to buy drugs. And that's why we end up with a bunch of addicts in prisons.
That's right. Or crimes because a person was a drug addict, and that behavior led them into a whole variety of other behaviors that led them into prison. That's right.
Andrew Kessler, just the idea of, you know, when you're addicted to an opioid and how it rewires the brain, you know, a lot of people still have this idea that somebody's getting high and they're partying, that this is fun. It's not fun, right?
Well, of course, it depends on the substance of choice and the individual. But no, it's not even back in the 30s, the propaganda against drugs was reefer madness.
Yeah.
And it showed that when someone would smoke marijuana, they would completely lose control and do all sorts of unspeakable things. And that kind of propaganda, even today, 80 years later, is kind of stuck in people's heads. But that, no, that is not, for the most part, you know, the result. You know, I'm not a clinician, but it's quite the opposite. There's three types of drugs. There are stimulants, there are hallucinogens, and there are depressants. And opioid is a, for lack of a, you know, it's a depressant. You know, whether it's heroin or OxyContin or morphine or anything of the opioid family, yes, it's a depressant. So while if you're dealing with the you know, an issue like a drug like methamphetamine, then you may have someone who's you know, for lack of a better term, out of control. But with opioids, it's quite the opposite. Very sedate, and you know, very you know, the high is one that you know, people have described it as, you know, floating on clouds and whatnot. So yeah, it's and unfortunately, you know, as we, even though we talk about the opioid epidemic because that's what's causing so much overdose, cocaine and methamphetamine are on the rise too. And it's a and also, as someone mentioned before, we're also seeing fentanyl in cocaine. So it's really goes well beyond substance abuse. It goes well beyond opioids. The whole world of addiction, the whole world of substance abuse, is a very, very large universe. But to get back to your question, and because of that, to bring it back to your question, you know, we could see different kinds of behavior and different kinds of impact. But if we're talking opioids, it's not a quote unquote party drug, not at all.
David in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. My question was when President Trump mentioned the death penalty for drug kingpins. Are the CEOs and marketing people in the distribution and manufacturing of these drugs that flood these communities, are they kingpins? Hmm.
Doug Berman, I mean, just legally, what's your sense about that?
Well, my sense is that's not who the president is imagining, and I don't think that's who others think of first. Technically, these folks are selling legal drugs, right? So they've gone through the FDA processes to sell licensed materials. But I think the logic of the caller's question is, if we're really going to try to get to the people most responsible for flooding communities with dangerous drugs, they definitely ought to be part of the conversation. As Andrew mentioned before, there's a lawsuit going on right now with many states that's being seen over by a federal judge in Cleveland that is an effort to get damages from the opioid manufacturers because of the recognition that some of their false marketing and other handling of the drug and promoting it to doctors in the kind of way an earlier caller discussed has contributed to this problem, that they ought to be paying the healthcare costs, very similar to the tobacco litigation that led to a huge settlement and that ended up giving states the resources to invest more in prevention and treatment. And so I think that's not only something to watch, but it's a good example of where we identify a certain type of drug dealer and say, oh, those are the folks that should get the criminal justice response, whereas others, the ones that are doing this quote-unquote legally, if we're going to sue them at all, it's in civil court and all we're going to ask for are damages rather than a more serious sanction. And at the end of the day, I think in terms of what's going to be more productive, getting the resources from these big corporations to the states that can then use it to invest in treatment and prevention, that's likely going to have a much bigger impact, be much more valuable for dealing with the sets of problems our society is facing than to subject anybody to the death penalty, you know, either the illicit dealers working in fentanyl or the CEOs that were, you know, behind the promotion of the prescription opioids.
David in Clintonville, thanks for that call. San Ho Tree of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies has said that instituting a death penalty spec for dealing would, as he put it, enable traffickers to charge a higher risk premium, that it would start to jack up the price all the way down. Andrew Welch Huggins, I mean, there's more risk, and so it's going to be cost you more now, or I can charge more.
Yeah, I don't know. That's I'm wondering if that's putting too much giving. And now I would hate to ever disparage a drug kingpin, but I'm wondering if that's
giving them too much credit.
And that also now we're sort of getting into that territory of you know, the opposite argument has been made for years that by enacting a death penalty, it's a deterrent because the person who might be about to commit a murder is going to have second thoughts. Now, there's, I think, generally speaking, there's very little evidence that the death penalty is a deterrent, and I'm not sure there would be much evidence in the other way that somehow this would create a premium product because I'm taking a bigger risk.
Though I do think, though, Ann, that there's a broader reality that as you increase the prohibition footprint, as it were, more police, more prosecutors, more prosecutions, you do see at times a slight bump in the price in the drug in certain regions. The problem with that in terms of long-term prevention and our ultimate goals is that spike in prices, and I think this is what the policy advocate's comment speaks to, is only going to incentivize more people to come into this marketplace, right? If you see that you can now charge an extra $1,000 for being involved in that heroin deal or cocaine deal or whatever the case may be, that may at the margins make you that much more willing to be involved, or there's that much more money that can be paid for this particular mule. That's been the historical pattern with prohibition, is the tougher you fight it and the more you're able to drive up the cost, that might initially lower the number of users because they can't afford it, or the number of people willing to take the risk to be involved there. But then over time, the forces, the invisible hand of the market kicks in, and more drug dealers are willing to get involved, especially if there's less prosecutions over time. The ability to sustain, for financial reasons and fatigue reasons, a persistently aggressive enforcement mechanism. You can go back to alcohol prohibition, where that's most obvious, where even though there was a huge push for interdiction and prosecution early on when prohibition first became the law of the land, over time, the willingness to keep going after folks diminished over time, and you get the speakeasies and the widespread bootlegging that there just can't be. There wasn't the energy and the resources to chase
after.
It was
a whack-a-mole situation,
exactly.
Ultimately. And then, you know, to go back to something that the caller from Cincinnati said, who thought that maybe if people could see the evidence of executions and the death penalty, and maybe that would teach them a lesson. Andrew Welsh Huggins, what's your experience as a reporter covering these issues as far as how that affects? Because, you know, we have the Goolsbee case here in Columbus right now.
Sure.
The jury is still out on the sentencing on that. But it could be years. If he is given the death penalty, it could be years before it ever takes place. And most people aren't paying attention by then, right?
Right. And if you're talking state court death penalty cases, we're waiting for the governor right now to rule on clemency in a case that's 32 years old. And the federal death penalty system often drags on as much or more. So you're right. There's an impact effect here that you can sentence said drug dealer to death. But with appeals, it could be, sure, two decades.
And lessons learned are lessons learned quickly, not over the course of 20 or 30 years. Andrew Welsh Huggins, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, Associated Press legal affairs writer and author of the 2009 book, which is still relevant, No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Also, Douglas Berman, thanks to you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate it, too.
Douglas Berman, professor at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. And Andrew Kessler, thanks to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Andrew Kessler, a behavioral health policy consultant. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.